Tom Nappy?
Yes.
Oh, that is Paul again. The one lawyer is your
The one who's asking the questions. Yeah, okay.
Good morning. Just before we carry on with Ms. Maher's evidence, are there any housekeeping or other procedural matters?
Just one minor matter of before.
Oh, yes, thank you. And we have concluded in relation to that.
Yes.
We compliment Ms. Faulkner on the succinctness of her evidence. We have no questions arising. So on that basis, as I understand it from your indication, no one else does. She is excused. Her statement of evidence will be received by us as a statement of evidence. There's no supplementary or further questions in relation to it.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very well. Thank you. Ms. Maher, you recall, and I can't remember whether you made a note or gave an affirmation yesterday in relation to your evidence, but in any event, you recall your promise to tell the truth?
I do.
You remain on that today.
Yes.
I think we were up to Wairaki Pastoral, Ms. Crumbs. Mr. Tolkien's forward questions. You did have questions, that's right. Thank you.
Good morning, Ms. Mark.
Good morning.
I just want to start on hopefully a nice, easy one. In regards to overseeing, you had quite a lot of discussion with my friend Mr. Thompson yesterday around overseer, and I just want to confirm that you weren't suggesting overseer be used for, that it was a useful tool for the CDP, were you?
No.
Thank you. Looking at, so HortNZ is proposing that existing CDP is enabled at a freshwater management unit scale as opposed to the sub-district scale. And I just want to talk about that a wee bit. Mr. Easton has given written evidence that the expansion of CDP is not into the Whangarei catchment. And your evidence is that the FMU scale is too big for CDP, but in your rebuttal you offer an alternative acceptable solution to Fish and Game, that if a separate FMU for the Whangarei catchment was provided and precluded that wetland from CDP, then that would be acceptable to Fish and Game.
Yes, I think if Whangarei is separated as an FMU, then the rotation of CDP at the FMU level will not
would that address your concerns with the CVP framework?
For existing CVP, I think that largely covers the key concerns. And I think with the other changes that are noted in the JWS for planning around expansion, so inclusion of the table at the beginning, I am satisfied that the framework would be consistent with objectives. There is the outstanding matter of the offsetting policy, which I still have concerns with across all the different land uses, not just the use.
So, just to break that down and clarify a little bit, if Whanganui was its own FMU, putting aside the offsetting concerns that you have, you'd be comfortable with, you'd accept that CVP at an FMU scale is appropriate?
Yes.
Let's look at offsetting them.
Yes.
So you're aware that CVP occupies just 0.6% of the PC1 catchment area?
Yes.
And that it contributes about 2.5% of the diffused total nitrogen load?
Yes.
And less than 1% of the diffused phosphorus load?
Yes, I'm not familiar with the figures, but those sound about right, to my understanding.
And if we look at an example of CVP expanding into dairyland, that would likely result in a decrease in E. coli because of the reduced ruminant species of that dairyland into CVP, correct?
That's my understanding.
And if that were to occur, it could result in a modest increase in nitrogen, but quite a significant decrease in E. coli.
That's my understanding of the technical evidence is that there would be an increase in nitrogen, possibly sediment as well. But yes, because as the animals are taken off the land, there would be a decrease in E. coli.
And that might provide a net positive benefit to the overall health of the river, wouldn't it?
I don't think so, because the health of the river, E. coli is a relevant contaminant of concern for human health, so it would result in a positive impact on the human health metric. But E. coli is not very relevant for ecosystem health, but nutrients are very relevant for ecosystem health. So I think in that scenario, there is a risk that there would be an adverse impact on ecosystem health.
So the objective 2 of the plan is looks at progress over the life of the plan for the whole of the all of the contaminants of PC1, correct? I'm looking at the post-conferencing version.
Progress over the life of the plan by meeting interim target action stats within 10 years.
And that's for all 4 contaminants?
It is.
So if over the life, if there was a significant decrease in E. coli immediately, with the, or, you know, in the short term, I guess, that could contribute to, over the life of the plan, the protection and restoration of the river.
That would be
would contribute to the E. coli attribute. It would make a contribution towards achievement of that. But it may result in an increase in nutrients and sediments, which would be moving in the opposite direction to that which the objective is seeking, because it's seeking to achieve each of the target attribute states, not just some of them.
And you're aware of the work that is going to, you're aware that farm environment plans have risk assessments to look at how other ways to mitigate all contaminants?
And that's my understanding of the purpose of an MVP, yes.
And so if we get a significant decrease in one contaminant through a change in land use, for example, with other mitigating and risk assessments and other measures going on to reduce the other contaminants, would that be an appropriate offset?
No. No, the National Policy Statement for Fishery Management is really clear on this point. It's seeking at least a maintenance in the policy, and it's seeking an improvement where degraded, and it has a clear action to avoid over-allocation. Over-allocation is where target attribute states are not being met. And in this case, the freshwater quality experts are agreed that increasing in some contaminants in an over-allocated catchment is going to compromise achievement of objectives, and increasing over-allocation is directly contrary to the National Policy Statement for Freshwater Management.
You talked yesterday around the concept of trading up in regards to Tangitiwa ancestral land. Can you just explain that concept of trading up again?
I'm not sure that I talked about trading up. You might have to remind me.
So that was, my understanding was around that trading up was that if there was, in some instances, where there was a decrease in one contaminant and there were appropriate mitigations and others that, in some instances, that was appropriate. But again, this is just to help my understanding of that concept.
Sure, I think that you might be referring to Ms. Ormond's legal submissions on Tangitiwa ancestral land. I think she talked about going straight to compensation might be appropriate in those circumstances.
Yes, that might be it. Thank you. Yes, sorry, that is. So that compensation is the positive benefit elsewhere, and then offsetting is an improvement elsewhere. So if you offset, that is where you offset one factor against the other, and that creates an improvement elsewhere in the catchment.
So my understanding of best practice around offsetting is that best practice is to go through the effects management hierarchy first, so avoiding as much as practical, and then moving to mitigation, then avoiding to remedying, moving to remedying, and then only when that's been done as much as possible and there are residual adverse effects, moving to offsetting. And then only if that can't be done, moving to compensation. And that structure through those steps, the amount of certainty of the positive outcome they're seeking reduces. There's evidence that we're hearing about offsetting, there not being very great methodologies for calculating the difference between an input and an action somewhere else. There's a lot of uncertainty. So moving through that structured approach is very important to ensure that the water quality, in this case, outcomes are being achieved rather than we hope they are being achieved. And compensation is the least certain in that hierarchy because if it doesn't meet the principles of offsetting, there is more uncertainty that it's going to address the effect, that it's going to be successful, or that you might be trading off values in that case. And so it needs a very careful analysis of whether that is actually appropriate in the circumstances. So, yes, compensation is the very last and most uncertain part of that framework.
I'm just trying to find the correct reference in the plan to policy 5, and I think that comes through in the principles of schedule D2, I think. Just trying to find the correct reference here.
There's a reference to policy 3 as well.
Yes, thank you. Yes, so the effects management hierarchy being avoid, escape, remedy, offset, and then compensate. Policy 3 sets out that where that policy can't be met, then offsetting in accordance with, or compensation in accordance with policy 5 is undertaken. So does that not address your concerns that the effects management hierarchy is being taken into account?
So policy 3 B and 4 talks about when policy 3B3 cannot be met, policy no compensation is undertaken in accordance with policy 5. Policy 3B3 talks about there being no material increase in contaminant loss. So that sets a at least maintain threshold. And 4 is if you can't at least maintain, you can move to policy no compensation. So we would be relying on policy 5 to do the work of setting out what a robust offsetting and compensation framework would look like. So it talks about avoid, minimise or remedy, but it doesn't apply a strict hierarchy, which a good offsetting framework would. It would require avoidance as much as possible for moving through those steps. And the other thing it doesn't do is that the offsetting step, it doesn't require
there is in the post-conferencing version, though, that offsetting and compensation is provided for only after adverse effects have been avoided, minimised or remedied.
Yes, it does. Does mention avoid, remedy, or minimise. Yes, but it doesn't apply hierarchy between those two things.
But offsetting and compensation is to come after.
Afterwards, and that's right.
I'd like to move now to minimum standards. So in your rebuttal evidence, you agree with Mr. Willis that minimum standards should be included in the plan for CVP. That's at paragraph 35 of your rebuttal evidence. Have you heard anything over the past 4 weeks of hearing that would change your mind?
I understand that Mr. Willis has moved away from that position. But generally speaking, I think if there are minimum acceptable standards for CVP to operate in a way that is consistent with minimising, then it would be useful to set those out on the plan rather than them being subject to a case-by-case assessment at TPP level, in the same way that pastoral farming has got minimum standards around fertilizer application rates and setbacks. If there are minimum acceptable standards to the industry, that would be useful to set them out in the plan. But I'm not aware that there's any consensus about what those minimum acceptable standards should be, so I'm unable to firmly say what they should be. In principle, I think it would be a good way to regulate.
So you don't have any evidence to suggest what those standards might be?
No, only in relation to setbacks from all bodies, where I think the risks of sediment runoff from cultivated land would be similar to setbacks needed for activities like cultivation on pastoral land or things like intense point grazing, because those carry similar risks to sediment runoff. So it might be useful to apply the same setbacks in both cases.
But you haven't provided that evidence for how what those minimum standards should be for CVP, have you?
No, I haven't.
And you're aware that HortNZ has provided evidence for why minimum standards are not currently appropriate for commercial vegetable production? And you haven't provided evidence contrary to that?
No.
Thank you. No further questions.
Just following up a couple of issues you raised yesterday and this morning, and just by way of clarification, you've emphasised the importance of the National Policy Statement for Fisheries Management 2020, and within that the construct or concept or whatever one wants to call it, of the Manawatu Way. That's correct?
Yes.
And as I apprehend it, you're saying that we should be going as far as we can to realise the particular requirements of the PDS in the development of PC1 as it's currently before the court.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, it's my evidence. We're required to give effect to the NPCFM as far as practical for the nurse proceedings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if we look back at the history of the NPCFM, we go back to, I suppose, the development and pre-notification stage of PC1, wherein what's in place, and that point is probably a very fresh NPS 2014, that's correct.
That would be right.
And that has a fleeting reference and a preamble to the term Te Manawatu Wai, but without a definition or any operative effect or resonance through the rest of that EBS, that's correct?
I don't have the text of the 2014 version in front of me, but that is my understanding.
Yeah. And then it was the 2017 amendment to the 2014 EBS FM that introduced in a more substantive way to Manawatu Wai as a first objective and as a matter of national significance, again, almost in a preambular statement at the front end. That's correct?
Yes, it might have been that version that introduced an objective and policy around that. Gave it a bit more life in the operative provisions.
I think that's probably fair. I think there was an initial objective, AA, I think it was,
yeah.
So they put in,
yeah.
Which was to consider and recognise Te Manawatu Wai and the management of fresh water for the policy by every regional council making or changing regional policy statements of things to consider and recognise Te Manawatu Wai, noting that Te Manawatu Wai recognised the connection between water and the broader environment, Te Hauora o Te Taiao, the health environment, Te Hauora o Te Wai, the health of the water body, and Te Hauora o Te Taiao, as other health of the people, and the values identified through engagement and discussion with the community, including Te Manawatu Wai, must inform the setting of fresh water objectives and numbers. That's right?
That sounds right.
Yep. And so that came out in 2017, again, after the notification of this, and it was that kind of version that was, again, a soft touch and slightly different, well, significantly different, I would say, in relation to the way we have today, that was before the hearing panel. And so in 2021, we have this quite significantly articulated concept of Manawatu Wai with three priorities and a set of principles which resonate strongly with some of the more principles and values, references to kaitiakitanga, mana whakahaere, manaakitanga, and then I suppose on the other side of the coin, there's other nuances, lenses, governance, stewardship, and care and respect, which I'm just trying to reach out to other parts of the community.
Yes.
If that's what we're grappling with there, would you agree though that fundamental and embedded throughout the NPSM FM 2020 as an obligation when giving effect to that NPS to engage in detail with Tangata Whenua to actually go through the process of identifying relevant values, developing targets, even identifying the FMUs, etc.? That's all part of that process.
Yes, the NPS gives quite strong direction to councils about active involvement in terms of Whenua in developing the plan change that is compliant, fully compliant with the National Register by going through the process that's set out there. It uses very strong directed language in it.
And you're not suggesting that somehow the council in advance of knowing that the 2020 NPS was coming along, had somehow complied with all of that engagement and have developed, worked with Tangata Whenua on all of those matters, such as to meet those procedural requirements and substantive outcome requirements, I would suggest.
I don't have insight into the process the council needs to develop PC1, so I can't really comment on whether they did or didn't.
But would you accept, with they'll be able to comment on that, that if the council is, as the evidence has been presented to this court, is it just embarking on that process and is looking at engaging with Tangata Whenua over the next 12 months in relation to those matters, including under the co-governance, co-management arrangements with the Waikato and Waipa River Iwi, that we need to bear that strongly in mind when we're considering the extent to which we look at the NPSFM 2020 and try and give effect to it within PC1. Because we don't have that input, do we?
We don't.
We've got a whole fundamental process of engagement and development of kind of inward values.
Yes.
Which council on its evidence hasn't commenced, or is only just commencing. And if that hasn't occurred, we need to bear that in mind before we can say we're trying to apply the principles of the NPSFM 2020.
Well, what I think that might lead to is that there's more to come, that there is going to be a more, what I would anticipate, the next plan that is notified next year will add more, because it will need to articulate Tangata Whenua values, and it will need to have developed those provisions by actively involving. So what I anticipate is that there's more to come, that there would be more added.
But as you say, there's so many different principles and processes pervasive throughout the NPSFM. So again, I just put it to you, we need to be cautious in terms of adopting bits of the NPSFM and trying to apply them directly into this plan change when that process has not been carried out. Because you're suggesting, it seems to me, oh, you can do bits of it, you're just missing the Māori element, which seems very compartmentalised and convenient.
No, that would be the wrong way to articulate my evidence.
Yes,
absolutely.
Right. Good. That's why I put it to you to correct.
There are parts of, as you have pointed out, parts of the NPS 2020 version that you can trace back to earlier versions, and there are parts that are quite new. And some of the parts that I'm referring to around water quality and how to manage it have been in the NPS since the beginning. The NPSFM now has very clear, very strong requirements for actively involving Tangata Whenua. And I expect there will be more to come. And there will be more to come because of the engagement process with other parts of the community as well. But I don't think that more to come stops us from giving effect to the clear directive language that's in other parts and the objectives and policy that's not part of the procedural part of the NPS. Where that is within the scope of submissions, we should be moving in that direction.
Ms. Maher, I wonder if you've looked at the evidence of Mr. McIntyre on behalf of the Iwi of Hauraki, where he complains that the PC1 process was conducted without engagement of Iwi of Hauraki.
Yes.
And that, for me, fails to engage with policy 2 of policy 2.2 of the NPSFM.
Yes.
I think that's the point Mr. Ferguson is trying to get to. And I may be misquoting Mika Jump from wrong. But the issue appears to me that there has been a lack in the development of this policy, PC1 document of engagement with Tangata Whenua. I suppose Mr. Ferguson is trying to say you can't just adopt parts of it, leaving out the engagement part of Mark. Do you accept that?
I think that if there is an identified problem that Tangata Whenua values haven't been incorporated and we know what they are, then we should fix that.
We don't have to know what they are. You have to engage.
Yes.
So that's the issue, as opposed to knowing what they are, because you won't know what they are until you engage.
I 100% agree with that. But I don't think that lack means that we should ignore other parts.
accept that. I think the key is having that active engagement, which is required.
It's vital.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Sorry, Mr. Jackson.
No, no, quite right. It's appropriate for you to ask a question regarding Hauraki, because I couldn't possibly ask that question.
No.
I do many things for Mr. Majuri, but you know, it's not one of them.
No.
Let's see what affections do.
That's how I
Well, perhaps one example that you've just had a conversation with a friend in relation to CBP is around offsetting compensation. So and I just wanted to touch on that in light of your views, which are strongly influenced by the MPSCP in 2020 in that respect. At least it's one of your influences. So you'd acknowledge, and I think it's broadly acknowledged, that two things. One, that part of the re-establishment of the relationship of, I'll say, tongue to fennel, I mean, keep the border embraced, with the Waikato and Waipara rivers, has a utilisation aspect to it. We're not all just boxed into a spiritual and cultural and environmental corner in that respect, as is so often the case, and that that's been articulated in a number of concerns regarding essentially being shut out of that development opportunity in relation to tangata whenua ancestral lands at the very least. So you've heard, and we are aware of that issue.
Yes, I am.
And so it's part of while we are clearly moving towards doing effective to Te Whanganga and restoring and protecting the health and well-being of the Ola, including to the reduction of discharges, we've got a slight bit of attention, but there's this need to also accommodate some form of development for tangata whenua ancestral land in a way that doesn't erode that progression. You'd agree with that?
Yeah.
And I suppose that then begs the question about how one might best do that. And we obviously had originally a non-compliant land use change provision, so we had some objectives and policies that pushed in that direction, but we didn't have a rule that enabled it in the form of a discretionary activity law or something of that nature. We had a non-compliant activity law, but it originally had a sunset clause, which was intended to be a big stick for the council and everybody to know that come that sunset date, there would need to be a real rule that does enable all this, and it just hadn't been grappled with at that point in time. Now, the hearing panel, in its wisdom, removed the sunset clause but didn't amplify the path for tangata whenua ancestral land, and that's a concern for the River Iwi, it's a concern for Hauraki, it's a concern for CNI. When I read your legal counsel's submissions and saw an acknowledgement about this issue, but also the comment that such opportunities for tangata whenua land should be appropriately named, e.g. limited compensation provision, it kind of sparked in my mind that potentially you were talking about assuming there's some connectivity between that statement and your views about offsetting the compensation in terms of policy 5, that was the vehicle you saw as the appropriate one. Accurate or not, or are you thinking there needs to be something a bit more bespoke?
I haven't turned my mind to what the provisions look like in detail right for that. I think that if there is going to be development of land, two things need to happen, as you say, and that needs to happen within the context of the river, the quality and the health and wellbeing of the river continues to improve, so it must assist in moving in that direction. And if, as I think the objectives of the plan already signal, there's a priority that within that to provide for development of tangata whenua ancestral lands, that the plan should have a framework for that.
and that framework would ideally be prioritisation when considering development of land for time-spent ancestral land, and a framework that shows how development in one area isn't going to move in the opposite direction to the objectives, if you like, in terms of improving health and well-being. That's ideal. I don't have a clear view in my mind about what the provisions look like to achieve that, but I would say that I would support that outcome.
Because part of the challenge when you look, for example, at the offsetting compensation provisions, and this comes through, I think, when one looks at the schedule of appendices to the NPSFM, is that they are very applicant and property specific. So that offsetting compensation is a personal onus and obligation, in that sense. And so there's obviously some significant challenges, both practically, and I would suggest that it's a matter of equity in placing that burden entirely on tangata whenua seeking to remedy and overcome historical and some contemporary impairments to development in order to, I suppose, not get to the front of the line but to be able to compete with the existing players, is it? So with that in mind, it may be that some can meet that test, for example, perhaps the conversion of the CPP, which obviously has a much more minimal impact on the evidence, not no impact as you've emphasised, but a minimal impact. But do you think that a better planning approach would be to look at something more bespoke in terms of both a rule but also a policy that kind of sets some of the parameters around how that rule might operate relative to the fact we are trying to move down a path of restoration and protection?
Yes, I would support a bespoke policy framework that addresses those issues that you've raised. That sets out how the objectives are achieved while also providing for that development that is designed and should be at the front of the queue, as you say.
I mean, one of the things that, and I don't think it's the elephant in the room as such, but one of the things that's kind of silent within the framing of Chapter 311, C1, is the fact that the intention is to reduce discharges and improve. The modelling suggests that these measures, to a greater or less extent, will begin their process and make advances. And so there will be headroom, the phrase created in terms of the fact that in current state we are improving and therefore there's some headroom or some capacity we can move beyond the over allocation of discharges. But in that regard, if part of that headroom is the equity, the opportunity to provide the equity for tangata ancestral land, in other words, they're able to develop utilising a portion of the improvement. So we're still tracking, but they're using a portion of that. And essentially, I suppose, CPP has been keen on the same progression to some extent, because they still have a negative impact. Is that something that perhaps warrants a little bit more optics within the wording of the plan? Because it's silent at the moment about this.
It is. And I think the difficulty with providing that kind of framework is what you've explained needs an allocation framework. It needs to be able to understand how much is being reduced by the FEP actions, how close that gets us to the 10-year goal, and it requires there being a bit extra. So that reduction being a bit more than what's required to get to the 10-year goal, so that bit more can be taken up by, for example, development of time-spent by ancestral land. And that, in order to know that you can do all that and achieve those 10-year
moment it doesn't. It's sort of a direction travel framework rather than a we know we're going to get there framework.
Well, yeah, but this is this three aspects of that being focused on. One is, I think we're all clear, we're not doing allocation by stealth here, and we're certainly not doing it expressly, but we all know it's coming in on the horizon. It's a fair observation. You would agree with that?
I don't think there's any way to avoid allocation in the future. But I think by issuing consents for discharges, that kind of is allocating discharges because you're expressly giving somebody permission to do them. So I would say there's no allocation in this framework, but what there isn't is a clear framework for how much is going to be allocated to which activities, and that is ideally what needs to happen in the next few changes.
Yeah, well, I mean, we can have a yesterday debate about whether it's all consensus or allocation or not.
Yes.
Yeah. but allocation in the sense that, you know, that tongues of people with fear and other people rub their hands at, which is, you know, a proprietary, tradable kind of portion or right, you know, leads to some people have described as hydrocracy, that's all, so, which I thought was a fantastic word. It's not what we're grappling with here, but that would be a potential future regime if we were getting to that point.
Yes, but certainly no structured framework in for that.
Well, and I suppose the second point is, based on the modelling and based on unless you get no faith at all that the modelling is accurate or that these measures as proposed by PC1 will have any effect on reducing, we will have a line of reduction. We just don't know how much.
Yes, my understanding of the modelling that's been done is the direction of travel was in the right direction in most catchments. I think the number was somewhere around 80% of catchments are expected to achieve the 10-year goals, which leaves 20% where my understanding is more than a bit not expected to meet the goals.
Okay. And so within that then, while we might not have precise allocable figures, to use your phrase, we have got certainly less than catchment data or less than catchment modelling that leads us to have a degree of comfort that we will be making progress during that period. So there will be some headroom, just size and quantity may not be readily discernible, and certainly not within the life of the plan we have. Would that be fair?
I think what I understand from the modelling is some comfort that in most catchments we will get to the 10 years, but when you say the word headroom implies that there's room between where we end up and the target attribute state, and I'm not clear if that's actually the case or not. I'm not saying it's not, I'm just not sure that the modelling gives us that level of nuance.
Right.
If there's room in there, if there was, then development of land without offsetting would be appropriate because we're still making adjustments. But I'm not aware of any modelling that shows the situation that level of nuance.
But if you were looking at a role for the development of potentially ancestral land, one of the considerations in relation to that within the role itself or as a matter of policy could be the council having regard to the kind of cumulative reduction that has occurred within relevant subcatchments. Put it to one side, measurability and things of those nature. That would be a pertinent factor, wouldn't it?
A pertinent factor would be are
because the goal is really clear and numeric, I'm not sure that having regard to is necessarily helpful. Because my concern is making decisions that lead to additional cumulative impacts on freshwater that move us away from the direction of travel we're trying to go in. So it does need to be quite structured, and that's why we have the NPS in 2020 version that we do, because decisions in the past being made without that structure and without those careful considerations have led to a gradual decline in health, wellbeing and water quality. And decisions made on a case-by-case basis have cumulatively added up to a degradation. And the structured approach is necessary to make sure that decisions made on a case-by-case basis add up to improvements.
It doesn't. The natural consequence of that is that you're saying you can only develop temporary interest or land if you can prove empirically that whatever discharge you're going to have fits within a headroom that is provable and able to be established and doesn't detract from the moving towards the tires. That's your view.
Well, that's my understanding of what the policy is telling us to do.
Appreciate that we're talking about what we might be able to do with the policy.
Yes.
Is that your view of what should be?
Yes, that's the kind of framework the plan needs. I haven't seen any words that develop that framework up, but that kind of framework is necessary.
And is that the same reason that you opposed the CVP extension?
The CVP expansion.
Which has got figures that show that there's an increase in discharge, albeit 0.9%.
Yes, that needs to come with the offsetting in order to make sure that everything adds up to improvement.
But they're in a position that they can't offset, they're not trammelled by the impediments of history like time to be done.
Totally understand that, and I think that that is an inequity that should be addressed. So the question is how, money is the big one, obviously, because of offsetting costs money. But what I don't think is that it's a useful framework to have for CVP or any other land use, a framework that suggests if there is a degradation that we should prioritise the development over the health of the water.
Well, this comes back to my point that if we have got a tracking reduction across the sub-catchment, you're wanting detailed empirical figures to be proven on a case-by-case basis, but it seems to be an impediment to just reattributing an impediment, isn't it? Because there's no modelling, there's no data sets that do that. The council hasn't yet set up an accounting system.
It is, the plan just doesn't have a framework to do that kind of analysis. And the council doesn't have an accounting framework to do that kind of analysis. So and those things would be ideal. In the absence of those, the best thing we can do is have a robust offsetting framework that ensures that the river benefits in the end.
But the report you established offset doesn't help time to get on essentially on this. Unless you're planning to be much of a time for the burdens that have been placed upon them.
No, I don't think they should.
Well, just touching on that last point, I suppose the accounting framework is fundamental to the success of this plan change and what comes beyond.
Absolutely fundamental. And that requirement for an accounting framework has been in the NPS since 2014.
And it's not just the in-stream measurements and attributes, which also need to be extremely regular and in an appropriate places, but also the on the monitoring, including data from the on-land, on-farm activities as well.
Absolutely, yeah. The data on activities, about what's been allowed, either by permitted activities or resource consents, needs to be collected and fed into that accounting system. It's necessary to understand allocation regime, but also to develop a better plan framework in the future. Absolutely vital.
So that I'm clear, without that accounting framework, it's highly unlikely that objective 4 will be achieved.
Without that accounting framework, it's highly unlikely that we could have a planning framework that has an allocation regime that provides that clear space for someone to spend their own ancestral land to develop without a offsetting regime. It's absolutely vital.
Thank you.
Just a couple of queries in relation to the policy 102 redrafting or amendments that you proffered. One was just a question of clarification. In terms of policy 2BD Roman 2, and the issue of the appropriate specified period, I see you proposed, this is your proposal, that ensuring users required to reduce diffuse discharges to water to as low as practicable are completed within 8 years. That's right?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, I was just trying to just correlate that, and it may be that this was just intended to be a backstop to it, but when I was looking at the freshwater farm plan regulations and looking at the requirement of farm operators to have an action plan in Regulation 10, and Regulation 10.2a says the action plan must, for each action, identify safe, whether it is an existing action that has already been carried out on a farm or a new action that the operator intends to take during the next 5 years. So this is a 5 year, at least, statement of intent. And I don't know whether your 8 years was informed by that simply being a statement of intent, not necessarily a drop-dead date, and whether your 8 years was intended to kind of be a backstop in for that, or whether, in fact, having regard to the 5 years, do you think that should be 5 years within your CTVDC? I don't know whether there was a correlation here.
No, there's not really, except that my reading of those farm growing plan regulations is that there's not a lot in there that's very firm in terms of what needs to be done and by when, which in the context of the Waikato region, where we've got clear goals with clear timeframes, is not very helpful. It doesn't assist in getting us to those goals, and so regional councils are allowed to have more specific requirements in their regional plans, and in this case, because of the clear goals and the clear timeframes in the plan, it's useful to line up the FEP actions with those clear goals.
Yeah, it was just when I was looking at the things in Regulation 8 that have to be done, it's in terms of that farm operator must identify and assess fresh land inherent vulnerabilities, risks and farming activities, which must necessarily include risk of discharges, and must identify existing and new actions to avoid, remedy, and mitigate the risks identified, and set a time frame within which action must be implemented. Then when you're crossing across that action plan, that action plan is supposed to be identified, those intended to be taken within 5 years. So, again, I just wonder whether, whether you're talking about measures required, those would include measures specified in the action plan within a special farm plan, and therefore, if the kind of saying 10 techniques within 5 years. It's just giving them a bit more rule. I mean, again, I think it's probably a gap in the reads. It's not saying the farmer has to do it within 5 years, it's just a statement of intent. But if you could read those together, couldn't you, that your 8 years is providing a actual drop-dead date for those intentions, for those measures.
Yes.
And just one question, and this was raised with me, maybe it's unintended, and this doesn't think arises from your drafting, but in terms of the numbering rights, it's still on policy 2, and there's so much redlining that it's a bit hard to look at where it translates through to, but it, I think it's E, if it's a Microsoft print. So I think E says, used to say generally, but says not granting land use consent applications for changes in land use that increase the load of concentration of nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment and microbial pathogens toward the better land uses as of 22 October 2016. That's right.
Yes.
And the question was whether in fact that should be an or rather than an and between the sediment and microbial pathogens, because presumably if there's not granting land use consent or change in land use that increase the load of construction of any one of those, not all of them.
That's how I get it to be.
So it's a little read, isn't it? Rather than an and.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, no, just wanted to check because it seems to be, it flips a bit during the rest of the plan. This was one that somebody picked up, so
right.
I'm clear whether that was right. And maybe that's just a cross check we need to make sure that. We were talking about more cumulatively, and I appreciate, I think we just swapped this wording for a generic wording related to contaminants at an earlier stage of drafting, and we dropped in the names of the four and put end, and there are some where we might want to be considering them individually, we might need to be a bit more specific, or say each of, or something like that.
It would pay to do a careful check, and
how thank you very much, I don't have any questions. Thanks.
Any re-examination?
Ms. Mark, you were asked by Mr. Thompson about the issue of setbacks over 15 degrees, where the legal submission state that number of stock units in any paddock joining the wood body exceeds 18 per grade hectare at any time that the exclusion of stock requirement would apply. And you were asked some questions around set stocking and rotational grazing. And this was quite late in the day yesterday. You said it, the issue isn't binary in your view. I just wanted to know if you wanted to elaborate on that, given that we were quite rushed yesterday.
The issue between set stocking or rotation not being binary. I'm just trying to remember that yesterday. In those stock exclusion rules in Schedule C. My understanding is the issue that particular clause is trying to address is where you have a lot of stock in one paddock, even if there are not very many stock on the farm, if they are all in one paddock at the same time, then the density of stocking in that paddock can impact the risk. And so it's important that if there are a lot of stock in the paddock with the wood body at the time, that risk is managed. And the clearest, simplest way to manage that risk is to exclude stock from the wood body. When the stock are spread out across the whole farm, there will be fewer
Thank you. So do you think that the panels proposed by Fisher Garden, whether it's an 18 per grade sector at any time or a 24 or 4 per grade sector at any time, would force set stocking?
No, I don't think it would force set stocking. I think it would. The intention of it is to where stock are being rotation and grapes, and there's a number of cattle in a paddock at the same time, that the risk is managed by excluding the stock from the water body.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for your evidence and your discussion on with the council. I just want to ask some questions about the nitrogen risk scorecard, and I think I understood that you not you don't really support the use of. At the gateway stage of the proposed use of it?
My evidence includes the use of nitrogen scorecard as a gateway tool, provided that the plan is very clear that it is a gateway tool and not a tool for assessing actual risk, because it doesn't do that.
Mm-hmm. And part of the issue you have though is that it lacks attention to biophysical factors.
That's right.
So, what does the lack of the biophysical factors do to it that detracts from its use?
It's my understanding from the technical evidence that nitrogen risk scorecard deals with on-farm management factors. And it doesn't deal with biophysical factors, and that biophysical factors are about half of the risk. So the same farm system on free-draining soils is going to have a different actual loss of contaminants to one on water-draining soils. That's sort of set out in the evidence Paul Fonterra that talks about the comparison that they did between the NRS and OSEA, and that NRS was about 50% right. there's a gap there. Same farm system in the high rainfall areas going to leach more nitrogen than in a low rainfall area.
So are those biophysical factors things that land users farmers can they can't really change those, can they?
No, they can't change them, but they can change how their system responds to those factors. So, for example, the way that animals are wintered in a higher risk biophysical environment might need to be different than in a lower risk.
But that presumably happens in the farm environment, can't it?
Theoretically, yes, a farm environment planner should assess risk, taking into account the biophysical factors. That's why it's really important to make the distinction in the plan, that the, for example, NRS is a drafting aid, but it's not an assessment of risk. That assessment of risk has to happen through other tools like the EFL and other tools that are available.
So, the NRS gateway, as I understand it, talks about, it brings into, it assesses things that the farmers are doing in terms of nitrogen on their farms. And they are the things that they can address in their farm. Those are the things that they can change. They can't change the biophysical factors, but they can change the nitrogen factors in their farm management practices.
They can change
So I'm just wondering why the lack of the biophysical factors in the NRS school campus is all that important, because this is about, but I think XCMI is about changing farm practices and leading in a positive direction in terms of nitrogen in particular. And so what the fact that biophysical factors which the farmers can't change are not in the scorecard, why is that a problem?
It's a problem if the nitrogen risk scorecard is used as a tool for understanding the impact that farm has on water. So the farm can't change if they're in a high rainfall area, or they can't change the drainage characteristics of the soil, but they can change how they respond to those factors. And more might need to be done in a high risk biophysical environment. So wintering practices might need to change, or stocking rates might need to be different, or different things might need to happen in order to address the actual risk than happens in a different lower risk biophysical environment. So the farmer can't change the environment, they can change how they respond to it. And the NRS doesn't factor that in. Because it doesn't take into account life as the factors that's treating all farms as if they were on exactly the same landscape.
Right. Okay, thanks, that helps.
Good morning, Ms. Farm. I'd also like to thank you for your evidence. I think it was very helpful. And I'd like to get your views on how to get the best out of the FDP process. That's something you've obviously thought about. I'm looking at it from an overall best from the point of view of the proper receiving environment. And my questions arise out of my evolving understanding of the evidence that we hear in this proceeding, including your evidence on time, which I found particularly helpful and thought-provoking. You referred yesterday to the complexity of the process, and I think I have to agree with that. And as one example of that, there could be in the order of 5,000 FEPs collectively aimed at reducing contaminants by 20% within 10 years. So that in itself is a bit of a challenge. And the follow-on from that is there's no way of monitoring if any farm, any individual farm, or a superior farm, a CBP type activity, or any other type, how they are contributing to that. So there's no real method of measuring what the plan requires to be measured. The other challenge is that, in terms of nitrogen in particular, we will not know within 10 years whether the target's been met because of the travel time of nitrogen from some of the farms. Do you have a view on that? Do you agree with that, or do you think that's an incorrect assumption?
Not a water quality modeler, so I have to be very careful, but it's my understanding of those processes for how much it will travel through the soil and get to water, that how long that takes is going to be really different depending on where in the landscape it is. So in some areas that nitrogen will move very quickly into the water, and in some areas it will take some years. So I think it's fair to say that you will see some improvement from actions undertaken, because some of the water carrying the nitrogen is going to enter the water bodies quite quickly, but you're not going to see the full impact of those improvements for some time until all of that water moves into the water bodies where it can be measured.
I agree with that. And there certainly will be some where it could get to the water bodies in a year.
Yep.
In others it could be 20 years or possibly even longer. So I think it's going to be difficult to measure progress in terms of nitrogen within a 10-year period, particularly by the time you've allowed for consent to be granted, actions to be put in place, and the effectiveness of measures to really start to be noticed on the farm, let alone in the receiving farm.
Yes, there's going to be a lag between the plan coming operative, actions being put in place, and then what we measure in the water body.
That's good, thank you. Now, going to Dr. Jose's evidence, he's indicated that a reduction of 37% of nitrogen, current nitrogen levels from anthropogenic sources, will need to be achieved within the 80-year period. the issues, if we do use the risk scorecard as a drafting gate, and ultimately it's found that obviously it still has to be used for the allocation tool, with all its limitations, it's still the best one to make if you're thinking to do. How do we ensure that the directions set now do not align with what might be required later in terms of the allocation of the box? I suspect you might have thought about this, and I'd just like to get your views on that aspect.
It is a wicked problem. I think the framework that PC1 sets up needs to have in mind that long-term direction of travel. And in order to do that, I think there's two things it needs to do. One is it needs to achieve as much as it can within this framework now, because we need to start the journey and make big steps. And secondly, it needs to, while we may not be able to anticipate what the future regime looks like, it needs to not give away that future regime, so it needs to be not putting in place impediments that we need to be unwound in the future, or would make it difficult to achieve those longer-term goals when we've got a good framework for it. So it needs to do as much as it can, it needs to gather as much information as it can so we can inform that future process, and it needs to not lock in things for too long, so that goes to consent to, but also investment. So, for example, fencing, fences are going to be in place for 20 or 30 years. We need to make sure they're in the right place for those longer term goals. You don't want people to be developing land or converting to more intensive land uses when that might need to be unwound in the future. So it does need to have that longer term view. Both working towards it and not getting in the way of it. That makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. And just picking up on the information, your comments about information. Are there any additional pieces of information that should be being gathered as part of the first 10 years, or however long it takes to get the allocation regime in place, to make sure that we're not held up later because of a lack of information? Have you given any thought to that?
Not in detail. I think that the information that can be gathered through farm and borrowing plans and things like stocking rates and fertilizer application, which are set out as information requirements, is vital. We need to make sure we've got good information about the receiving environments as well, so where there are gaps in monitoring, those should be filled as soon as possible. Something that's set out on the technical JWS, that's quite important, because we need to make the connection, we need to understand what's happening on the land and in the water and make connections between those two things to come up with a future regime that manages. So the more information we can gather on that, the better for planning in the future.
Okay. I guess I'm thinking, I can't get away from the fact that the bond obviously is the only tool that's ever been used in New Zealand to allocate. And if the risk scorecard is to be developed to a similar level, it's going to take many years to do all the trials that demonstrate that. So are there any aspects of information that you're aware of that should be added to what's required in the planning at some time?
I think
plan is requiring any information about inputs in farm systems, so that stock, fertiliser, autumn feed, wintering practices, areas of winter grazing, for example, all the things that we know contribute to risk. It's important to keep, to understand what's happening on the farms and whether any areas are, any of those factors are growing or shrinking. We can't, obviously it's great for nitrogen, for modelling nitrogen, but we don't have a similar tool for sediments or E. coli, so we're going to need to understand inputs and practices and manage those carefully. So understanding where stock do have access to water and where they don't, and tracking that over time, where risk activities are intensive winter grazing happen, and the areas where that happen, all of those inputs are going to be really important to understand because they might be things that need to be managed in the future.
That's helpful, given us the concepts that we need to leave. Now, my understanding is that Nanjian Plan is really directed at ensuring critical source areas are properly addressed, that streams are fenced, that waterways are fenced to the extent they need to be, and that there is provision for riparian planting in appropriate circumstances. Are those the three primary elements of intent?
And using farm environment plans to reduce contaminant loss as much as practicable. So that does go to critical source areas, but it might also go to other aspects, like intense winter grazing or the assessment that a farm planner might do on a property about how certain farm practices are going on. The farm system as a whole needs to be looked at to see if there's any tweaks that could be made. So it's critical source areas is a big part of that, but there might be other things that farmers talk about, how they manage their grazing or their rotation, or keeping animals out of high risk paddocks at certain times of the year, those kind of things across the farm system.
Okay. And you indicated a time frame of 8 years. Would that be for achieving all of those requirements on those elements? The fencing, the critical source areas. If they were achieved in 8 years, you would think that was taking the first farm environment plan as far as it could go. So that's a good statement.
Yes, the goal in the plan is to reduce
contaminant
or make contaminant losses as small as reasonably practicable.
Yeah.
That's the basis on which modelling anticipates will achieve the goal. The goal is 10 years, so we need to move at least that fast. So I've picked my 8 years so that there's time for changes to have effect.
To be quite honest, I thought that 8 years was probably a very realistic time for the programs. Then the next stage of development when the allocation framework comes in.
Mm-hmm.
I sat on the Te Waikaraupupu water conservation order case, where we actually allowed 15 years from the plant becoming operative to when the implementation of the required measures were in place,
right,
simply because of the timescale that's required to achieve some of these big changes.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a view on that? And what I'm getting at is that it's critical that the allocation framework is set as soon as possible, and hopefully in the next plan change, rather than left to the one after that, because it's going to take a long time before the effects of those changes are in place. Do you have a view?
Yes, as I understand it, certainty is really helpful for future planning. So farm owners are having to make decisions about investments, what they invest in,
how they run their properties, and this long-term certainty that a plan can give them easier just to make those decisions. So if the plan or a plan or future plan like clearly signals the direction of travel and the changes that would be required, that's useful. And then taking into account how much change is required, how much that might cost, it's sensible for the necessary for the plan to give enough time for those changes to happen so that the investment can be spread out over that amount of time. There's nothing that requires change to happen immediately, and it's sensible to take into account the costs and the management changes that need to be made in order to achieve those goals.
So, picking up on something that Ms. Ongi mentioned in her submission yesterday, was the need to be clear in this plan that there is more to come and it's significant. And that the planning in this FMP should take into account that that was coming. Is that your view as well?
Yes.
Okay. And so, do you think, it's something I've raised before, is do you think there's any benefit in having a section in the first environment plan saying options that will be considered to achieve significant reductions in the future? Is that something that is premature? Or could it have some advantage in terms of getting people thinking about where to make the plan and need to go?
That is a useful suggestion, I think, because it's important that that people don't assume that the first farm plan is all there that needs to be done. The plan has been really careful, but it doesn't send the signal that do this and everything's fine. It needs to be very careful to say this is the first step and there's more to come. So yes, and I think that's consistent with Dr. Crystal's evidence too, that farmland should take a long-term view and be updated and ongoing and never end. So if the farmland template sets that up, then that would seem to me to be consistent with your evidence as well.
Okay, thank you. Just one last question, and it relates to the definition of critical source areas. You made a comment yesterday about concentrated contaminants, and I wonder whether that should be the basis on which the definition is framed. That what I took from that is that any area where contaminants can be concentrated and present an increased risk to the environment is a critical source area. Is that sort of thing you're getting at, or not?
Yes, that's my understanding. It's the combination between the contaminants caught by a concentration of stock, for example, and its transport to the port body. Those two things make it a critical source area, is my understanding.
Yeah, well, that seems quite a tidy way of looking at it, you know, based on what you've said. And then I still see some merit in referring to the Regional Council publication on that gives you visual understanding of what a critical source area could include, but not exclusive. So I just put that out there to see if someone can help me and come back with save me having to do some work myself. So thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
As Mara just made a comment about farm plans never end. Of course, they say planning never ends. And that's one of the reasons politicians hate plans, because you can't just do it and so it's done. I'd like to ask you or discuss with you a few things around risk and intensity of activity. PC1 obviously is framed in a way that's very much about identifying and then managing risk, isn't it? The rule structure, particularly for pastoral farming, is a wee bit of a mix because it's largely about controlling activity by its intensity, isn't it? I mean, there's a rule for small, very low intensity farming, low intensity farming, moderate intensity farming, and then we get rule 7A added in, high risk dairy. But generally speaking, it's about intensity of the farm operation rather than the assessment
In this case, it is.
Yeah. Right. If you look at the rules, particularly for pastoral farming, schematically, I haven't managed to type this up yet. Other than activity class or status, the framework for pastoral farming is very similar across the rule structure, isn't it?
Yes.
Registration in terms of Appendix A or Schedule A. Schedule C for everybody. And then either Schedule D1 or D2. Do you see a major difference between Schedules D1 and D2?
Yes.
And what would you characterise that as?
Schedule D1 is more prescriptive.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so
because it's likely to apply to permitted activity.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Right, okay. But conceptually, the two schedules are dealing with the same things.
They're both dealing with minimising risk continuance on farms. C1 is dealing with it in a prescriptive way. Do these things and we will be confident the risk is low. And Schedule D2 is describing a process to go through to assess risk.
Do you feel it's important to call Rule 7A, will say that Rule 7A is about high risk dairy farming, or would it be equally effective if it were about high intensity farming?
It's probably more consistent to call it high intensity. The other rules refer to intensity.
Well, indeed. I'm not sure if you've heard, or you would have read the evidence of Mr. Newman, who objected very strongly to having his activity characterised as high risk because he felt that he was taking steps to avoid or manage his risks, and he didn't like to be told, no, you're still high risk. Have you heard that evidence?
I didn't, but I had heard of it.
Oh. I asked him about how he would feel if his activity were called high intensity, and he said, I don't really have an issue with that. In terms then of managing the risk, as I think you've said, it's the farm environment plans that are going to be the actual tool to address that for each farm, rather than whether or not they're permitted control, restricted, discretionary or discretion. In my analysis of the rule, Schedule C applies across the board.
Yes.
So it doesn't matter what your activity class or status is, you have to comply with Schedule C.
Yes.
What do you feel is the main planning purpose of giving the different levels of intensity or risk, different activity classes or status?
A couple of, the main one I would say is where there is more discretion being exercised in the farm environment plan, or there is more inherent risk in the environment, in the case of the farming owners. The different activity statuses give the council more discretion at looking in and applying and questioning the decisions that have been made in that farm environment plan, which may be necessary where there is high risk, either from the farming system or high risk to the environment. So that's the key thing that the different activity statuses do. They give the council more look and more ability to inquire and to question the decisions that are made in the farm environment plan.
Doesn't that depend on the ambit of the matters of control of the state in the plan?
It does. The matters of control or discretion limit the council's look-in and their ability to question. being controlled, for example, in restricted discretionary, obviously there's the ability to say no, but because there's the ability to say no, the ability to say no to specific parts.
Been suggested that there may not be the ability for a controlled activity, for example, to control stock numbers. Do you share that view?
I have concerns in that area.
Even though stock numbers were identified as a particular matter of control?
Yes. Using that example, if the activity that I apply for is intensively farming beef with irrigation and 100 hectares intensive winter grazing, that's my activity. And the council looks at that and says, well, we think that you can minimise your risk by reducing your intensive winter grazing down 50 hectares, and we don't think you should do that. Does that then make it a different activity than the one I applied for? And I understand that that's a matter for legal submission. That's the concern that I have.
But if the activity which the plan purports to control is either beef or dairy farming, and they say that's what we're assessing, if it were clear that the council could say to you, when you come in front of it with an intensive proposal, in an area where it said we consider that controls need to be put on stock numbers and on what is assessed as nitrogen losses, and we will reduce that. As you say, there may be a legal argument. It does seem to me that if the character intensity or scale of effects is something which is specifically identified in the plan, then the applicant can't really say, well, I'm going to alter that by the terms of my application. All right. We'll leave that to the Supreme Court. So that would be the main issue, would be whether the degree of control of intensity at the more permissive end of the status or class of activity scale needed nonetheless to retain a degree of discretion over the grant of consent at the higher end of the scale.
Yes.
And the biggest issue would be whether or not consent were refused in its entirety in relation to a particular intensive proposal, as distinct from working with the applicant on the terms and conditions of their farm environment plan in order to achieve the objectives and policies of the plan.
Yes, I think if you were going to move towards a regime where, for example, everything was controlled, there would need to be conditions on that controlled activity rule around not increasing intensity or increasing risk, for example. And matters of control around how certain things are happening in order to avoid any gaming where people might use it for intensification by stealth.
One way of avoiding gaming would be to make every activity above low intensity, which you might retain at a permitted level, but make everything requiring a discretionary consent and putting everybody through the same hoops.
That would be one way. Yes, quite a regulatory burden on all involved, that would achieve the outcome.
Well, the issue then is whether or not that kind of regulatory response is needed if you felt that gaming was a serious risk.
I think that what the rule framework needs to be able to do is give the council the ability to look in, assess, and have an opinion on things rather than a framework like permitted activities where the council can't do any of that. It's just, and that's fine for low risk things. Mm. But as you move up the risk profile, the rule framework needs to provide the ability for the council to look in, assess, and have an opinion on things. and
or to say to move up the intensity profile in terms of the point of view of the applicant.
Yes. And as long as the council's got that ability, it's fine. And that looking will be described, and that's where the control activities and restricted discretion are quite useful, because they put some boundaries around how much the council can get involved. Mm-hmm. They can't take into account landscape factors, for example.
Indeed. I mean, that kind of crazy approach on how the consent authority can be controlled by saying, is that relevant to the provisions of the plan? But I hear what you're saying. Mm-hmm. It may well be it needs to be spelled out for certain consenting officers. Finally, if we turn to page 22 of your version of PC1, page 319.0347, and your additions, I think, to Schedule D. And I understand the paragraphs that I think have been added, the methods to assess the risk, and then the category thresholds. I just wonder whether in a regulatory document, putting it in a regulatory section, is inviting people to say, well, they don't believe it themselves, so why should I be bound by this? And I wonder whether those paragraphs would be better, perhaps in explanatory material at the front end of PC1, or alternatively be in explanatory material outside the plan entirely.
The concern that I was aiming to address with those words is that Schedule B contains draft engaged material, nothing else. And that I do think that needs to be spelled out somewhere, because I think that there would be a temptation to say, oh, well, I've moved my NRS or from 70 to 68, therefore I've reduced risk, but that NRS isn't useful for that purpose, and it needs to be clear.
Well, indeed. I mean, one of the reasons for me asking you questions about the character of the rule structure and the way it works and whether activity status makes a great deal of difference is because if we are getting to the point where the issues around overseer or not overseer or the NRS or not the NRS are really only coming down to the drafting date, and I suppose what I'm putting out there is, to what extent do we need to be that fine-tuned about the drafting date? And you've raised the issue about the measure of control and the measure of discretion, and I understand that. But it seems to me that in order, given the uncertainty that we have around the use of models generally, and given the short period of time that we have to get moving, to some extent, a rough and ready drafting method will have to be endured just so that we can get through the process and understand what rules people that have their applications assessed against. Do you agree with that?
I absolutely accept that. We have to accept rough and ready, not wait for perfect.
And so, those paragraphs, well, unquestionably true, seem to me to raise doubt as to the regulatory foundation for the whole drafting gate process. In the same way that if I were driving on the road and it said 50 kilometres an hour, but then it had underneath it an explanation to say, well, this is a figure that we've drawn on because we think overall in terms of accident and death and injury statistics, this is a reasonable speed limit for this suburban environment. But it's not an absolute, then I'll take my ticket for travelling 55 kilometres an hour and say, well, I really shouldn't be convicted. So I just wonder if we're perhaps explaining too much in the plan change. I don't doubt that in the Section 32 evaluation, I don't doubt that in the reasons that the court will have to give for whatever decision we reach, we should explain ourselves. But in terms of what the council officers or the farm plan supervisors or anyone else takes out into the paddock to say this is why you are under rule 4 rather than rule 3 or under rule 6 rather than rule 4. You just say that's the way it is.
Absolutely. Whatever the drafting gate is, it is. Once it's stated in the rule, that's what it is. What I'm trying to address with those words is that's all it is.
I understand that. I'm just not sure if schedules and rules in a plan change is where that explanation is.
A more elegant way of doing it might be to change the title, for example, and not say that it's an emergency risk, but to say that it is, this is the drafting gate and leave it at that, and that might address the problem.
Thank you very much. Is there anything arising out of the court's position?
I just have one matter of clarification about the 8-year proposal for implementation. Environment plans, whether that relates to fencing.
Because if the fencing is required. If the fencing is required by Schedule C, Schedule C has different time frames in it. Thank you.
Thank you. Just one matter. In response to a question from Commissioner Maven regarding the scorecard and overseer, you mentioned a 50% figure that you thought came from Fonterra's evidence, and I was just racking my brain trying to work out where that might have come from. But could I take you to page 306.0047? And this is the Abacus Bio report. Is that perhaps what you might have been referring to?
That was what I was referring to. I'm sorry if I misspoke and got my technical terms wrong.
So just in terms of that, and neither of us are statisticians, so I'm not going to go through the detail of it, but just as far as the executive summary on that page.
Can you give me the page reference again?
Sure, that's 0047. So 306.0047. Let's get it up into the summary. And if we just go to the third paragraph, the second sentence, the moderate accuracy of prediction of overseer end loss to water from the scorecard is encouraging, and then it says given that major environmental data are not included, and that's the point that you are driving at.
Yes, I understand the statistical number was something around 0.5, which indicated...
As far as the variance,
yeah.
I think it may have been. And I just want to take you to one other aspect. If you just jump down to the next paragraph, down halfway through, it says several sub-factors have been significantly overweighted for the level of impact on overseer end loss observed. And it says, however, this is considered appropriate as there are effects over and above consideration only on the basis of impact on nitrogen. The main example of that effluent discharge destination has been significantly overweighted because it potentially has major impacts on water turbidity and water pathogen content. But yes, just based on that, while the risk scorecard, there might be some variance in terms of how it predicts nitrogen loss. There could also be some benefits, couldn't there, as far as looking at some of these other factors, as far as sediment and E. coli?
Yes, there
is.
very much for your efforts.
Just a couple of things there. Firstly, I've reflected overnight on our discussion about adaptive management and how you manage cumulative effects, and I have to agree with you that it is possible, but my submission I just wished to clarify was that the framework of PC1 doesn't provide for it. Secondly, would you like me to refile my legal submissions with the footnotes that I went through yesterday fixed up? Because I did make a number of corrections.
Yes, well, I think I certainly attempted to keep track of that, but I'd be very grateful if you would file a version 2, which has them in the form that you intend them to be.
Yes,
that would be the safest thing.
Thank you, sir.